creative destruction, and the digital commons.
The story of Viral Spiral is about the evolution of a free culture in the online world, which has been this spiral, a viral spiral occurring over the past generation.
That's David Bollier. We talked to him about his latest book, Viral Spiral. It's about how the internet is changing our idea of value.
So if you're making art that you don't intend to have copied in the 21st century, I don't think you're making contemporary art.
And that's science fiction writer Cory Doctorow. His new novel, Makers, imagines the birth pangs of a new remix culture. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The idea of the commons is an ancient one. Peasants of medieval Europe seldom owned their own land. Legally, it was held by the nobles, the king, or the church. But they did have the right to use certain lands in common to grow crops, cut wood, or graze livestock. As capitalism took over from feudalism, the commons began to be privatized. First, land and forests were enclosed. As commodity relations spread, more natural resources like water followed suit. In our own era, privatization has gobbled up a huge new arena of the commons as intellectual property. From the patenting of traditional plant varieties and the copywriting of traditional folk tales, to the human genome and biodiversity itself. David Bollier says the enclosure of the commons by the market is one of the paramount injustices of contemporary life. But, he says, the emerging digital commons of the internet is exerting a powerful counterforce. It's all about a value shift from limiting access to throwing it wide open, creating benefits for both individuals and social communities. Bollier's work focuses on the politics, economics, and culture of the commons. He edits a web portal and blog on thecommons.org and co-founded the digital rights advocacy organization Public Knowledge. We first spoke with Bollier in 2005 about his book on the excesses of copyright law, Brand Name Bullies. His latest book is Viral Spiral, How the Commoners Built a Digital Republic of Their Own. I started out our interview by asking Bollier what viral spiral means.
The spiral refers to how viral communities create all sorts of innovations, which then become the platform for a subsequent generation or cohort of people. And my story, the story of Viral Spiral, is about the evolution of a free culture in the online world, which has been this spiral, a viral spiral occurring over the past generation, from free software to the invention of the Creative Commons licenses to all sorts of online commonses, as I call them.
And you've been actually working on this whole issue of the commons, even more broadly defined than this, for a while. First of all, define the commons for us in the sense that you've been working on it. Tell us how you got involved with it, and then tell us, what's a digital commons?
Well, the commons is both an ancient subject as well as a modern one. It has its roots in antiquity, but it's most known in English history when the commoners owned a pasture or the forest or some common aspect of land that they all had access rights to use for their own subsistence or personal purposes. What happened in over the course of several centuries is that the aristocrats and landed gentry decided they wanted to privatize the commons and use it for their own market purposes. And so you had the so-called enclosure of the commons. Well, this is, I consider, one of the paramount injustices and problems of contemporary life, the corporate and market enclosure of resources that belong to us all. And so many people are trying to reassert the commons as a way to say, no, these open spaces belong to us. No, the human genome should not be patented. No, the atmosphere belongs to us and should not be a privileged dumping ground for corporations. So the commons is really a broad-based movement to reassert collective control over things that belong to all of us, most of which belong outside of the market. And the internet is one area where the commons is very robust, because people can create them so easily. There's very low barriers to entry to creating a community managing its own information resources. So these are digital commons. And my book is about the story of the rise of many digital commonses.
This is a fascinating story. Your book has many fascinating stories in it, not only about the development of this digital commons, but even the development of how the Internet itself became such a fertile ground for this commons. How did this come about?
Well, the Internet was incubated in academic computer science programs under the auspices of the Department of Defense, improbably enough. But as an academic community, they're what is often referred to as a gift economy, where people didn't have transactions the way do in a market with cash or contracts or things like that. You gave stuff to the community, and in return, you got all sorts of benefits. Well, they constructed in the very protocols and design of the Internet, made it so that it was a sharing structure, a matrix for sharing, as opposed to a place with toll booths and checkpoints to pay money. So this was in the 1970s. By the mid-1990s, when the World Wide Web was invented and was unleashed on the Internet, giving it far more functionalities than it ever had before, it evolved according to the design as a place where information and photos and text and video could be shared. And so we had this very unusual challenge to typical market ways of doing business, and a whole new sharing economy or sharing culture has grown up.
You mentioned this gift economy, and you have talked about the whole rise of copyright. You make pretty clear in your book, Viral Spiral, that you are not really against the very notion of copyright itself. And you just mentioned, you know, this idea of a free universe, basically, on the Internet. What you really critique is what's happened to copyright. Now, so I wonder if you could go through a little bit of that. This was a subject that you treated at much more length in your book, Brand Name Bullies. But give us the gist of this.
Well, as the Internet took root and people could suddenly share things with each other and create their own communities apart from the market and get useful stuff done, a lot of the traditional owners of copyright, the music industry, the film industry, the publishing houses, were profoundly threatened. And so they increasingly lobbied Congress to expand what their copyright protections would give them, longer terms for copyright, less fair use rights, meaning the ability to freely excerpt things without paying any money or getting permission in advance. And so you had a whole array of laws passed to expand the privileges that copyright owners had at the very time when the Internet was making it easy to share things for free. So you had this profound cultural clash between whether a market order as governed by copyright should prevail or whether this fledgling new order based on free sharing and minimal market activity would be able to get a foothold and grow itself. Copyright laws were enclosing our cultural commons. And my book, Brand Name Bullies, mentioned all sorts of ludicrous examples of this, where trademark law was being expanded so that, for example, the Village Voice was claiming a trademark in the word voice as applied to newspapers and suing newspapers that used otherwise.
And you even had Girl Scouts being sued for singing songs around the campfire.
The Copyright Clearance Society, ASCAP, decided that when Girl Scouts and other campers at summer camp were singing around the campfire, that was a public performance that needed that a fee had to be paid to for the songwriters and publishers of those songs.
And yet, all this time, you also talk about the fact that these corporations were appropriating what had been in the public domain for a long time. Tell us about the public domain. What are the attitudes towards it, and how is it being rescued by the Internet?
Well, historically, the public domain was regarded as a wasteland, a place where you had old government documents and sheet music from the 20s and basically junk that nobody wanted unless you were some sort of curiosity seeker. And the reasoning was that if it was valuable, there'd be a price tag on it and it would be sold in the market. Well, the Internet started to change that when suddenly things that didn't have a price tag on it could be shared and communities could generate stuff as well. And it was all outside of the marketplace. So over time, the public domain in the past maybe 15, 20 years began to be seen as something perhaps valuable. And in fact, we've seen how Wikipedia is a vast public domain of material that people have created, or free software and Linux, something that is not owned as traditional private property, tremendously valuable and generative. So the idea, the public domain has sort of morphed into the commons, the public domain historically being seen as inert, and it's a legal term of art, the commons being a more reflecting a social community that supports it and generates the value. So the public domain has sort of morphed into the commons in the internet world, and all sorts of tools are being created to try to protect the commons.
And then I want to go back to the first point, however, which is that, in fact, these companies are also taking what has already been common, for example, the copywriting of plants.
Well, this is an across-the-board phenomenon. The Disney Company, for example, built much of its empire on plundering fairy tales and other stories in the public domain, giving it a proprietary spin, and because of its market power, was able to essentially supplant the folk culture and start charging. They even sued when somebody tried to use Snow White, claiming that they owned a trademark in Snow White, even though, of course, Snow White has a long history as a folk character. But you see this as well in plants, where companies from the first world are going into India or other places with a lot of biodiversity and claiming patents in agricultural crops, and sometimes making a small genetic engineering modification and saying now it's proprietary, even though it took centuries for the commons to cultivate that seed. So you see this phenomenon in many areas where corporations are essentially stealing from the commons, turning it into a proprietary product, and basically disenfranchising the commons from its fruits.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with David Bollier about his latest book, Viral Spiral. It's about how the internet is redefining the digital commons to create social communities that generate value. Bollier says the idea of the commons isn't inimical to markets or private property. He argues, rather, that the commons and the market need to coexist.
One should recall that the commons has always been essential to markets. Even Adam Smith had a companion volume called A Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he described how certain social morality was essential to functioning markets. It's just that over time, people could plunder the commons without it being recognized, or people were too powerless to do anything about it. In the past generation, however, we've seen technology make it much easier for corporations to exploit the commons, and we've seen the law expand to protect that as well. And furthermore, we're reaching outer limits of it. I mean, the genome, the atmosphere, the ocean seabeds, all sorts of areas that historically have been protected from market exploitation are now being open to private market exploitation and destroying our ecosphere. So in some ways, the market is going to have to learn that the Earth truly is finite and it can't continue in its current path.
I want to go back to your use of the word free here, because there are differing definitions of what free means in this new internet culture. You discuss it in your book, Viral Spiral, David Bollier, when you talk about open source software.
Free has two meanings. One, of course, no cost. But the way that many people in the free culture world, meaning both free software and the Creative Commons world, describe it, they mean politically or legally free, meaning you have legal and political access to information as opposed to at no cost. So the point is to allow information and other creative works to circulate freely, meaning their circulation can't be restricted. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's no cost. So, for example, Linux is a free software program, but there's all sorts of companies that add their own tweaks and release it as a commercial product for which people pay, sometimes packaged with service and support. So the more important point is this is a political freedom that's the essential point, not that it's no cost.
Well, you've been using the term Creative Commons several times here. Define what Creative Commons, what the Creative Commons license is.
Under copyright law, everything is born as property. You can scribble on a piece of paper or tape record your guitar riffs, and it is born copyrighted. This is under the 1976 revisions to the copyright law. Well, this sounds great, perhaps, but when the internet arose and digital technology started to proliferate, it was a disaster because it meant that everything created had an envelope of property rights around it, and so as a legal matter, could not be shared without permission or payment. So you could download something from a website or visit a website, and it would replicate a copy of that website in your computer. That's legally not allowed because you're making a copy. So all sorts of things were suddenly suspect. They may not be prosecuted, but they might. And that's the very point, the uncertainty of whether you could use things legally on the Internet. So a number of legal scholars, activists, artists, computer scientists, and others, led by Professor Lawrence Lessig, got together to create what are called Creative Commons licenses. And what they are licenses in which you, as a copyright holder of a works, can say, I'm applying this license to my work to signal in advance that people can use it however they want under these conditions. And some of the conditions are, so long as you give me credit and say that I'm the author, or so long as you don't use it for a commercial purpose, or so long as you don't make a derivative work, in other words, modify or change it. So the licenses are a very important way to basically legalize the ability to share things in digital environments, especially the Internet. So it's a major legal advance for countering the strict copyright control that major copyright industries assert.
So we've been talking about different kinds of license, a Creative Commons license. You yourself actually have distributed this book, Viral Spiral, under the Creative Commons license. Tell us what your restrictions are on it.
Well, my publisher had to be persuaded that it might be more valuable to do this. Let me just tell a story that a friend of mine said that really there's only one thing worse than being sampled on the Internet, and that's not being sampled. So the point is, a lot of value is created simply by being accessible and available on the Internet. So my book is available on the Internet at www.viralspiral.cc and can be downloaded for free under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License, meaning you can do whatever you want with it provided you acknowledge that I'm the author and you don't use it for a commercial purpose. I've had more than 1,000 downloads already. There's many authors out there who have built their careers upon releasing their books online because it gives them visibility, and they still sell many, many commercial hardcover books and make money.
They do. They actually sell, because I think this is the biggest question. Copyright originally came about in order to protect the livelihoods of artists, to ensure that at least for a certain period of time, and originally it was 20 years. As you point out in the book, that's now become the lifetime of the author plus 75 years, I believe it is. So there's a big difference between the two. But how are people going to make money by releasing their work under the Creative Commons license?
Well, we're kind of caught in what I call an interregnum, a transition period, because a lot of the existing industries are very reluctant, if not downright hostile, to changing their business models. They have too much invested in the infrastructure and ways of doing things. You know, the movie industry, the music industry, they don't want to change. And yet the newcomers haven't been able to get enough of a foothold to grow new business models that are based on an easier sharing and non-exclusivity of content, although we're starting to see it. So in different creative sectors, it's working out in different ways. How do we come to terms with the radical efficiencies of the Internet? I call this the great value shift, meaning that more value is created by being open and accessible than being exclusive. Copyright is based on being exclusive, but that's a one-way ticket to oblivion and no value. Value is created by people tuning into what you're doing, sharing it, circulating it, and that's why you see lots of TV shows putting their stuff on the web for free, because they want to be known. They want people talking about them. When the New York Times put their op-ed columnists behind a paywall and people had to pay for it, so they took the paywall down, and now you can read Maureen Dowd and Paul Krugman for free. So there's this tension that is still being worked out in each one sector after another. Should we make the shift? How can we make the shift?
You mentioned Lawrence Lessig. Tell us a little bit more about who he is and what he did, and then I'm going to ask you a question that relates to what you were just saying.
Well, Lawrence Lessig was a Harvard law professor at the time. This was around the year 2000. And he was profoundly disturbed by the drift of copyright law and wanted to try to do something about it. And he mounted a constitutional test case against the so-called Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which was a law that the Disney company wanted because Mickey Mouse, among other characters, were coming into the public domain. Mickey Mouse was about almost 75 years old, and in 2003 was going to be in the public domain. So Disney prevailed upon Congress to extend the term of copyright law by 20 years retroactively, meaning for works that already existed. And it's, of course, absurd because if copyright's supposed to be an incentive to get creators to create new things, how do you incentivize Robert Frost or Walt Disney, who are both dead, to create more things? You don't. It was just a rank giveaway to companies that had inventories of copyrighted works. So Lessig mounted a constitutional test case about this, saying the Constitution says copyright must be for limited terms, yet under Congress's act, where they had extended copyright terms 11 times since 1960, he says it's not limited anymore. Well, he lost in that case, but in the course of it, he educated much of the American people and the press about copyright law, and at the same time got this whole Creative Commons project underway as an alternative way to deal with too much copyright law.
Okay, so he has, by the way, he is an electrifying speaker, and I watched his talk on TED on YouTube the other day. At the end of his talk, he inveighs against what he calls extremists on both sides, both the Disney types, you know, who sue Girl Scouts for singing songs around the campfire, but also the kids who think that everything should be free. He says those are both very dangerous.
Well, he sees that there's much more credibility, moral and political credibility, on basing a movement of this sort around acknowledging and recognizing the value of copyright as opposed to celebrating simply using things without authorization for free. What is often known as piracy, a term that is, of course, misused and abused by the industry, but there is such a thing as using works without permission that ought to be respected. So he saw long-term value in respecting copyright and rejects some of the so-called piracy efforts. At the same time, there's a disagreement within the movement about whether such acts are really civil disobedience, which are necessary to send a signal to the industry that they're trying to impose their own regressive market relationships on people when a more open and free social relationship is what they want and many others do. So there's a tension between so-called pirates or civil disobedient people using works the way they want.
We're speaking with David Bollier about the digital commons and the new values it's creating. His book is Viral Spiral.
One of the great things about the commons is it's not reflexively anti-corporate or anti-market. It simply wants a more respectful, mutually beneficial relationship between the two. And there's a lot of companies that are so-called open business models that are experimenting in this regard, trying to find better ways to meld what the commons creates with what they can create. And it's less dependent upon raw market power or repressive government copyright laws than a respectful conversation with the commoners and what they can produce. So, for example, there's a number of communities devoted to extreme sports, like extreme skiing, extreme skateboarding, and so forth, which are often the incubators of innovative equipment. The fans there in those sports will develop this new stuff. Well, many of them are working in tandem with the companies that produce the equipment, and it's this sort of mutually synergistic relationship. And you see online, in the same way, many of the new open business model companies are saying, we respect you as a community and want to satisfy you, and we're not going to try to have strict copyright claims. So, for example, there's a company called Magnatune, a new music label that has its own roster of artists, and it allows you to buy the music for between $5 and $18. You choose what the price, but you know in advance that 50% of it straight up, without any accounting gimmicks, will go to the artist. And so it's a way for people to express their appreciation to artists they like, knowing that they're not going to get jerked around and that the company is not a predatory, typical music label. So it's a way to show respect for the community, and the community in turn will show a loyalty and commitment to the company. And so this is one new paradigm we see in a lot of online companies where the company looks to a community to be word-of-mouth advertising, to do R&D, research and development, to provide innovations that it can capitalize on, And the loyalty and cohesiveness of the community, if focused with the company, will benefit everybody. So it's really an interesting new model that transcends a lot of the traditional adversarialism between companies and consumers.
So are you really talking here about a paradigm shift? I mean, you spoke earlier about having a new conception replace the old market conception. It occurs to me as you're talking that people are actually learning that new conception not by thinking about it, but by doing it.
By doing it. Frankly, the theory is following the action. And I think that it hasn't come to consciousness because we haven't quite articulated in a cognitive kind of way what's going on. The market's not going to go away, and the market serves many valuable purposes. But I don't think people have come to appreciate that non-market forms of value creation, like the commons, also deserve to be studied. And in fact, I've been working with two UMass professors, James Boyce and Nancy Fulbray. We started a six-part lecture series that's going to be starting this fall called The Forum on Social Wealth. And the point is we want to have a series of speakers talk about a new progressive vision of wealth and value, which the market philosophy simply doesn't capture. And so this is another gambit to develop the commons paradigm and explore it more, bring more to consciousness.
It's a very exciting kind of development that you're really talking about here. And I really wonder if there's any putting the cat back in the bag.
I think increasingly less so as the internet becomes more of a social reality and more economic and cultural and creative behavior migrates online, because the dynamics online are change the economics that and the traditional real life intermediaries are losing their power, and we're kind of in a death struggle with them, and whether and how they will transform themselves, transform their business models to an online environment is really the open question.
I mean, the only real wrench in this business that a monkey wrench that I could see being thrown in here is, I think of, you know, as we speak of this increased democratization of content provision, we're also living at a time when government is becoming more secret, more controlled. We're losing our civil liberties. Do you see any kind of coming collision in terms of government control and the internet?
Well, increasingly the government is an afterthought because they can't, their policymaking is no longer as paramount or decisive as it used to be. It was almost laughable, the Supreme Court checking in on the Grokster decision for file sharing for music, whether that should be allowed or not, because whatever the Supreme Court says is going to be bypassed by hackers and new software programs. And in some ways, the power has moved from law and public policy to the technology and the social practice. It's not as if it's public policy and law is irrelevant, but it's far less influential and powerful than it used to be. So this in its own way is a paradigm shift from the liberal vision of government representing our interests to the sovereign control by ourselves of our own interests through our own technological means. We can't surrender those battles in Washington, but in some ways they'll come after we fortify ourselves as, if you'll excuse the term, commoners.
That's great. But in China and Singapore, they do have government control over the internet.
The internet is not necessarily as open as it is right now. People should not think that it's immutable or inevitable that the internet be open. Governments can successfully control the internet, at least sufficiently for their purposes. Long term, it'll be interesting to see if China is able to do that, both as a technical matter, but also economically. Can they grow as a country but have everything under wraps? That's really a big question, because the power, the creativity, the innovation that is unleashed through an open system, which arguably is America's great contribution to the world, can China do that too? I have my doubts whether China can grow and prosper economically without loosening itself up politically and culturally.
David Bull, your book is Viral Spiral. It is a terrific read. It's absolutely fascinating. You've got a lot of wonderful stories in it and also a very fresh perspective. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure.
You can find out more about Bollier's work on the commons at writersvoice.net, as well as a link to the blog he edits on thecommons.org. Next up, we talked to novelist Cory Doctorow about his newest work of science fiction, Makers. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Creative destruction. It's the term economist Joseph Schumpeter used to describe capitalism's power to transform the economy through radical innovation. The digital revolution is the latest example, revving up the pace of creative destruction to ever higher speeds. At the same time, it's leading to a blossoming of creativity through copying, using mashups and remixes to create new content out of old. My next guest, Cory Doctorow, writes about the digital universe both as a blogger and journalist, as well as a science fiction writer. He's co-editor of the blog Boing Boing, a major voice in the development of the cyberpunk subculture. Its themes are technology, futurism, science fiction, intellectual property, and Disney. All these themes are central to his newest book, Makers. Set in the near future of an America in decline, it's about two geeks in a garage who create a new economy based on backyard invention for the masses. The new work, as they call it, takes off with a mini startup in every abandoned strip mall in America. Then it crashes, a victim of its own success. The protagonists turn to building interactive amusement park rides, mashups and remixes of Disneyland. That gets the corporate giant on their tail, and therein lies the tale of the book. That gets the corporate giant on their tail, and therein lies the tale of the book. Makers is no anti-corporate screed. Doctorow has a nuanced take on capitalism that looks at all sides of the issues he explores.
I guess what I wanted to do was show in the round the different perspectives on creation and destruction and the imperfections of people who are involved in both creation and destruction. So, you know, you have a couple of executives for big multinational corporations whose oxes are getting pretty thoroughly gored, who for the most part act as you'd expect them to. They're not very happy about it and doing what they can to sabotage it, even though, you know, I think a lot of us would think of what they're doing as unethical or at least unfair. At the same time, you have people who are benefiting from the advent of this technology, who are at the center of this technology, who are kind of blinded to some of its downsides and whose own faults are put on display as well. And then you have finance people who, you know, on the one hand claim that they're just in it for the money, and on the other hand, eventually it becomes pretty clear that they're also in it because they're playing a game that makes themselves that they find really satisfying, far in excess of what any kind of reasonable person would think of as the best thing for them to be doing. They're doing it because they're caught up in the excitement of it. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time lately thinking about the idea of market rationality and this fallacy, I think, that people act rationally in the marketplace. You know, that fallacy's obviously been put on great display with the latest economic collapse. But, you know, I wrote Makers about the economic collapse one or two before that one. I wrote it about the dot-com collapse, which I'd lived through in San Francisco, arriving just at the peak of it. I rented half an illegal sublet for $1,900 a month, and you know, I had it pretty good because the guy, my next door neighbor, was the guy living in the backyard in a Sears shed for $800 or $900 a month. He liked that apartment because it came with a parking place for his Jag. I mean, that's how irrational people are in booms. And you know, I think that having all these people who are caught up in the excitement of the thing really helped throw into relief that irrationality that's a fundamental character of how we conduct ourselves when we do these big important things that, you know, and we like to look back in hindsight and say, oh, you know, we did this because, you know, we were thinking about the good of the world or the good of our investors or because it was a hard and interesting technical question. But at the time, I think that what we're really doing it for is a lot more complicated and also maybe simpler, a lot more emotional.
As the book begins, tell us what's going on. You have a journalist who gets a really great story.
The story is that some smart money people in Silicon Valley have decided to go corporate raiding in the Rust Belt. They've bought up Duracell, they've bought up Kodak on the grounds that nobody ever wants a film camera or a battery ever again. And they've liquidated them, and they're using the money to fund a bunch of little micro startups, a bunch of tiny little companies whose job it is to take open commodity hardware and open commodity software and combine it in ways that are not commodity. Combine it in inventive and innovative ways that don't cost much to do, right? It doesn't cost much to do that kind of invention because all the components that you're working with are essentially free or commodified, or commoditized rather. But once you've made it, someone is probably going to copy it and improve it pretty fast. So you don't have much time to make back the money either. So the idea is, you know, you kind of take $10,000 and turn it into $40,000 in 6 months. You may not be able to take $10 million and turn it into $40 million, but 10 grand into 40 grand is kind of doable. And the idea is that if they can get this up to scale, if they can just find enough kind of creative inventors out there who can think of novel ways of reconfiguring the world around them, that they can make back all their money and more besides. And so this journalist gets a gig to go and be an embedded journalist with the most promising of these groups, a pair of guys named Perry and Lester, who are hacker inventor artists who found a very, very cheap real estate in a dead half-built mall across from a dead Walmart in a dead suburb of Miami. And these guys basically are using all of the space and all of the junk around them to come up with really cool things. And that's precisely what they proceed to do with these guys' money. And she documents it as this becomes a dominant form of work across America. 20% of the American workforce ends up relocating to take part in one of these activities. And the investment capital that floods into the sector essentially capitalizes a re-education or a training, a very aggressive training program for anyone who's got any spark of entrepreneurial spirit or creativity to teach them how to become this kind of hacker. And in this way, this is the way in which I think it was a parable about the dot-com collapse, because that's, I think, more or less what happened with the dot-com collapse. We were able to take a bunch of stuff that was commoditized, that was just lying around, that was very cheap to use, URLs, and HTML and little pieces that were just kind of lying around and commodified, and combine them in ways that were decidedly non-commodity. And, you know, the investment bubble that followed basically turned anyone who wanted to drop out of a humanities program into an HTML jock or a Perl programmer at the expense of a dot-com. And that's kind of what happens in the book. And then just like with the dot-com bubble, although a lot of the stuff that came out of the dot-com bubble was really useful and great, no one knew how to value it. A lot of it was overvalued. A lot of it was undervalued. There was so much corruption in the system because there was so much money flying around that no one could adequately police it. And the whole thing just collapses. And one day, everybody just wakes up out of a job, essentially. And just like the dot-com collapse, they go on making stuff. And that was, to me, the most remarkable thing about the dot-com collapse in San Francisco, was that all the people who were left behind, who didn't just sort of pack up and move back to the Midwest or wherever, continued inventing essentially Web 2.0. And what they realized was that they didn't need foosball tables and espresso machines and offices full of Aeron chairs. All they really needed was, you know, a laptop and someone's wireless connection and some friends, and they could kind of invent an entire new web that way. And I think that's exactly what they went on to do, and that's exactly what the new work people go on to do. But just like Web 2.0 is problematic because it actually doesn't cost very much to build most of Web 2.0, and yet there's all this investment capital sloshing around looking for somewhere to go, so you end up with these overvalued companies that can't figure out what to do with the money and end up behaving pathologically, trying to figure out how to spend it all correctly and turn it into a profit. These businesses don't need much money either, and they end up flooded with capital and behaving weirdly as well, and no one can figure out where to spend the money. So this is the story. It's a story about creative destruction, and it's a story about how cheap it is to make stuff together under the right circumstances.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with sci-fi writer Cory Doctorow about his new book, Makers. It's about the rise of a new kind of economy, one where meaning supplants money as a motivator. I asked Doctorow what he thought about the idea that with the digital revolution, all content wants to be free.
Well, so I think free is a very interesting concept. You know, Chris Anderson from Wired has this new book out about free, and I think it's generally a very good book. It's all about all the reasons that people do things for free and about all the ways that people are making money for free. But I think that at the risk of sounding a little kind of woolly-headed and info-hippie-ish, I think he focuses too much on the money. And the reason that he focuses too much on the money is that I think some of the things that people do for free not only don't exist in a market context, but wouldn't exist in a market context. There's a fair bunch of stuff that I would do for free that I wouldn't do for a small amount of money, but that I might do for a large amount of money. So, for example, this interview, right? If you'd said – you emailed me and said, I do this podcast. I don't make any money off of it. Would you like to spend some time talking about it? And if you'd said and I'll give you $10 for your time, I probably would have said no.
Right.
Because when I try to price that out against the realm of things that I charge money for, like paid lectures, $10 for an hour's worth of my time is actually a very bad trade for me to make. But instead, you approach it as a social transaction. And when you approach it as a social transaction, when money didn't come up at all, I said yes. There's this really large realm of things that exist outside of markets for important reasons and actually can't be marketified, right? So as soon as you try to pay people, for example, for writing blog posts about their personal lives, right? Now, there's lots of different kinds of blog posts. But say I propose to you, I'd like your live journal in which you write about the things that are going on in your life and how they make you feel. I really like what you've been doing there. I'll pay you $3 a post from now on. And right now you're getting $0 a post, so I'm going to give you $3 a post. And that's a net profit of $3 a post to you, even though $3 isn't very much. I predict that you wouldn't actually do very well with it, that you wouldn't write much, that what you did write wouldn't be as good, and that it wouldn't be nearly as fun or rewarding for you.
Yeah, and exactly. And it's contaminating the motivation, which has been pure on the one hand. It enters in something else that then you have to think about. And so you have different characters in the book who really embody some of these different approaches. And you also go into copyright. There's a certain point at which there's a battle that is drawn, that is brought, that mounts between Disney Corporation, which I think you took probably the most perfect corporation to embody this these ideas of copyright infringement and the big corporation going up against these small entrepreneurs. This is after the new work bubble has burst. And these two guys that you're talking about have still been making things. In fact, what they are making are rides that are the story of the new work boom when it occurred, which is an interesting concept in itself. So give us the outlines of this. Tell us what's going on.
Disney is, as you say, a very apt company to talk about this, but I think maybe for a slightly different reason than the one you had in mind. Disney is actually one of the most prolific examples and most impressive examples of how good remix culture can be. Disney doesn't have a lot of original ideas. What it has is a lot of original ways of reusing ideas that already existed, right? So taking bits and pieces of folk tales or much loved stories and making new things out of them. I mean, for a great example of that, just look at Alice in Wonderland, which has just come out, and they're doing a lovely job reinterpreting one of my very favorite stories. It's probably not a coincidence that my wife is called Alice. And I think that everybody who does that is prone to a kind of exceptionalism that says, what I'm doing is art, but when you do it to me, it's theft. And it takes a fair degree of intellectual honesty for someone to go, actually, when I did it, it was art, and now that you're doing it to me, it's art too. And usually it doesn't matter, because usually, the people who claim that they're possessed of some mystic originality and that everyone else, and that the way that they, when they reuse things, it has this characteristic of mystic originality, and everybody else is a mere derivative maker. Usually those claims are kind of irrelevant because they don't go anywhere. It's they don't have a lot of market power. They can't get new laws passed and so on. But Disney actually does pass new laws. Disney has really powerful lawyers. Disney has really a powerful influence over society, and the way that Disney conducts itself has actually tilted the board so that what Disney did the first time around, no one else can then go and do to them. This is what I mean when I say every pirate dreams of being an admiral. That here you have Disney, which was only too happy to be thoroughgoing, sticky-fingered takers of culture and remakers of culture, characterizing everybody who comes after them as a thief. And so in the book, You have characters who are you have these characters who've built this kind of museum that's a tribute to the things that they built and they loved and they lost. And it allows anyone to bring in the things that they built and loved and lost and add it to the museum. It's a kind of cooperative museum. And people who are involved in a Disney project start to add this stuff to it. And Disney uses this as a pretense to chase them down using trademark law and copyright law. And because they're so out-lawyered, it's somewhat a successful tactic. And I think that this has a lot of parallels to reality. I think you do see today companies that have a lot of money and lawyers using the law and using their influence to stop anyone from coming along and doing what they did when they were getting started.
And on the free download site that you have for this book, Makers, Cory Doctorow, I'm going to quote what you say there at the beginning of this. This isn't part of your book, but it's a preface here on the website. There's a dangerous group of anti-copyright activists out there who pose a clear and present danger to the future of authors and publishing. They have no respect for property or laws. What's more, they're powerful and organized and have the ears of lawmakers and the press. So is Disney would be one of these anti-copyright activists?
Yeah, I think so. In as much as copyright recognizes two important things. The first is that people who buy copyrighted works own those works, right? Your parents can pass down their books to you. You can loan out books. You can loan out the DVDs that you own. You can borrow them. You can take them out of the library. You can sell them when you're done with them. You can buy used books and movies and music and so on if you want to get a start on it. And yet there is an enormous amount of energy being put into figuring out how to stop people, but using both law and technology, from being able to do that. And I think that this is actually deadly. I think that this is a deadly practice.
You say anti-copyright activists. You know, I just caught myself up short because I actually was thinking that you were talking about those like Disney who are trying, you know, Disney tried to stop people from singing, Girl Scouts from singing songs around the campfire. So those are copyright activists. But anti-copyright activists, I would have thought in some ways you who have made this book, Makers, available under the Creative Commons license, you're an anti-copyright activist in some ways.
Well, so no, I don't think so. So first of all, I think that copyright does and always has included a bunch of rights that users and owners of copyrighted works, buyers of copyrighted works get. So if you say that the only part of copyright I like is the part that allows me to stop people from copying my books and not the part I'm violently opposed to the part that allows people to say, quote books for the purpose of criticism or share the books that they own or resell the books that they own, all these things that are also part of the copyright law, you're an anti-copyright activist, right? You want to cherry pick the parts of the copyright law that you want, but by and large, you are setting out to get rid of some of the most important parts of copyright. Mm-hmm. Now, the Creative Commons licenses are copyright licenses. They're built out of copyright. So what they say is that I, as the holder of exclusive rights to this work, extend some rights to you, the public, over and above those rights that you get in copyright law. That said, you know, what I think copyright law is good for and what it's historically been used for is as a set of rules of the road to govern the interactions between creative people and within the supply chain of the creative arts. So it helps me by setting rules for what my publisher can and can't do in respect to me, by what the guy who optioned the film rights to my books can and can't do in respect to me, and so on. And I think that that's a really productive thing for copyright to do, and I think that we need to have those rules. But I think that as soon as you say, well, okay, copyright, which has historically only ever been a set of rules that applied to industrial relations between people in the creative arts, and that was designed and made to serve that purpose, now should extend to every situation in which copies are being made, even if those copies are being made in a way that has nothing to do with the copyright industries. You know, so people who go out and say, well, I own a copyright in my in my emails, and so when you hit Control R and the entire body of the email is imported into your new email, you're violating my copyright, and I want email programs redesigned so they don't induce people to infringe. I think that actually distorts copyright, and it waters down copyright to the point where it doesn't make any sense anymore, where nobody can make sense out of it and where it leads people to conclude that it actually shouldn't be respected at all, that copyright is just a kind of it's a set of bizarre, you know, quasi-religious rituals that have no relationship to reality.
We're talking with science fiction writer Cory Doctorow about his newest book, Makers.
You know, most people think about copyright as being protecting the artist's right to make money. You give away your book, and you, as you said before, you have a family, you need to support them. So how do you square your need to make a living with your willingness, your even eagerness to give your book away free in certain forms?
Well, let me, before I answer that, talk about what most people think copyright is for. Most copyright scholars, no matter what side of the world they're in, you know, and most copyright lawyers would not say that the point of copyright in the United States is for artists to make money. If that's its point, it's not doing a very good job. I mean, let's be frank here. And you know, it's not clear how copyright alone actually does that job. I mean, say you gave poets a million years of copyright, and you also gave them like a copyright axe that they could use to chop off the hands of anyone who copied a poem without permission. It's not obvious to me how that would make poets any more money. A little bit of copyright may help some people make money, but copyright itself is no guarantee that an artist will make money, even if they make art that people want to consume. And what copyright is for, what the Progress Clause of the American Constitution sets out the purpose of copyright as being for, is to promote the arts, right? That is to say that if we give creators some exclusive rights, it may incentivize the creation of more works. Now, they don't. The framers of the Constitution did not say that this is the only way to do it, nor did they say that Congress must do it. They said Congress may do it. Congress may create exclusive rights regimes in order to promote the useful arts and sciences, not in order to enrich artists, but in order to promote the arts. So, In terms of how I make a living from this stuff, I don't think that Creative Commons costs me money. I think Creative Commons makes me money. For me, the case for using Creative Commons commercially is pretty straightforward. It's what Tim O'Reilly says, that for most artists, the problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity, that the majority of artists, of audience members who fail to buy one of my books today do so because they never heard of it, not because someone offered them a free copy electronically. So as a result, even though maybe some sales are displaced, more sales are generated. And I think that this is true up and down the kind of food chain of the creative arts. People who are very, very, very popular, for whom piracy, obscurity isn't a problem. The experience of those people who've experienced a lot of piracy is that it barely eats into their income, that they already have a lot of income. And, you know, like progressive taxation, it only takes a small nibble out of a very, very large pie. For the people that no one's ever heard of, chances are nobody cares about their work enough to steal it. So they don't really have any piracy problem. And, you know, certainly that seems to be the experience of most people who use Creative Commons licenses, is that in and of themselves, while they do magnify any love that people feel for your work because they can share it with other people and kind of evangelize it to them, it doesn't generate any love for your work in and of itself. It doesn't make people want to run out and get your work just because it's there. And then for the middle class, say, the people who are moderately well-known and have some mechanism whereby it can make their works can be well-known. So, you know, I've got a publisher. My publisher does all the things publishers do to make works well-known. That Creative Commons generates some sales, more sales than it displaces. And so that's the commercial case for it. But I think there's an important artistic and ethical case to be made for it too. You know, artistically, it's the 21st century. I think it's implausible to think that copying is going to get any harder at all, ever. You know, hard drives aren't going to get more expensive and have lower capacities and be bulkier. Networks aren't going to get harder to use and slower. We're not going to get a smaller population of people who know how to Google and go to Google and type in, you know, Batman Returns BitTorrent. So from now on, copying only gets easier. And so if you're making art that you don't intend to have copied in the 21st century, I don't think you're making contemporary art. I think you're making anachronistic art. And, you know, I think it's cool that someone out there wants to be the blacksmith at Pioneer Village, and more power to them. But that's not my gig. You know, I'm a science fiction writer. I should at least be grappling with the present, even if not the future. And then morally, you know, I'm a copyist, you're a copyist, everyone I know is a copyist. When I go and give talks about copyright at big companies, including Disney, and I say, is there anyone in this room who isn't a copyright infringer? No one puts their hands up. You know, Disney's copyright lawyers know well enough about copyright law to know that they can't stick their hands up when I say, are you not a copyright infringer? Everybody's a copyright infringer. So running around and getting up on my high horse about copyright infringement just reeks of hypocrisy to me. And moreover, you know, copying is how I think most creative people got their starts. You know, my first story was when I was 6 years old, I'd come home from Star Wars and it was fizzing in my brain. And I went and I got all the paper in the house and stapled it into something the shape of a paperback book and rewrote the Star Wars story as I understood it. Just like if you go through Florence, you'll find in every corner someone's statue of the David, because for 500 years, the way that you became a sculptor in Florence is by taking the best sculpture you could find and copying it until you understood how it worked. Mm-hmm. So I think going around and telling would-be creators, especially kids, this corrosive lie that creativity doesn't involve enthusiastic, unpermitted, unauthorized copying at great velocity and with great verve, I think that that really does a disservice to creativity itself. And it also, I think, short-circuits kids' intuition about how creativity works, because I think intuitively everybody understands that the way you create is by starting by copying. You know, copying is really hardwired into us. We copy the way that we nuzzle for the breast, and it's not a coincidence, because, you know, the origin of life is when some 3 to 4 billion years ago, molecules figured out how to copy themselves through a process we don't understand very well. We are descended from things that figured out how to copy. Things that didn't figure out how to copy don't have descendants, right? That's what having descendants is. It's figuring out how to copy stuff. So I think that by approaching Creative Commons licenses, by affirming the ethical and artistic merits of copying, that I do things that make my art better and make my ethics better. And, you know, lucky for me, it also makes my bottom line better. It's you know, it sells a lot of books. You know, for an example, the book Before Makers, the one that's been out for a while, Little Brother, is a New York Times bestseller, 90,000 hardcovers in print, sold into 17 languages in 18 markets, film rights sold to the guy who made Natural Born Killers and Transformers, theatrical adaptation on in Chicago, and there's a bunch of inquiries to mount it in other cities. So, you know, like, it's done very well by me. And that book was available in stores as a free download right at the same time that available on the internet as free download right at the same time as it was available in stores.
Wow, that's a great example. Now, I'm just so curious, why did Disney invite you to talk with them?
Oh, because I'm a total Disney fanboy. My first novel was set in Walt Disney World. It was called Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom. I've written a long novella set there called There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow that's based on the Carousel of Progress ride. I blog about Disney all the time. A friend of mine who works in Imagineering says that one of the ways that you know that someone at Disney is cool is if you work there, is if you go into their office and you see my book, Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, on their bookshelf, you know that it's one of the cool people who work at Disney. So, you know, I've got lots of things to say to them because I think they make good stuff.
Writer Cory Doctorow. In addition to Makers, he's the author of the novel Little Brother, among others, and several story collections. His blog is craphound.com. You can find a link to the digital copy of Makers at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.